Hi, my name's Tori and I wish I knew more about blood products.
Hi, my name's Letitia. I wish I knew more about taking care of myself when starting shift work.
Hi, my name is Lydia. I wish I would know more about how to work as in a team and solve conflict.
Hello, welcome to Five Things, the nursing podcast from the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. My name is Liz Crowe.
I'm Jesse Spur, and this is a podcast by, for, and with the amazing nurses and health professionals in our corner of the world. We hope to connect with a global community as we move from surviving to thriving. Welcome to Five Things.
Hello, my name is Liz Crowe.
And I'm Jesse Spur.
Welcome to another episode of Five Things, and today we are welcoming Associate Professor Andrew Wong, who is the Director of Neurology and Stroke here at the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi. Thanks very much for having me on.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks for carving out some time in your day in between a whole manner of stuff, which we'll find out a bit of a what's a day in the life I've seen. It's customary for us, as you know, you listen to a couple, to just get a little bit of an origin story. So you're a fair way into your career. You're a director of a service in a clinical specialty. Where did it start for you?
My origin story goes all the way back. My mum's a royal mum. So her name's on one of those posters on the walkway and on the corridor there. But I did my medical training here as a student. I did my resident work here, and my physician training work was also here. So it's kind of been home for me for many years, a few decades now. I've got the badge to prove it. Eventually I came back as a staff specialist, took on the role as director of stroke. Obviously the powers that be thought I was doing a good job at that and ended up as a director of neurology.
What steered you towards stroke and neurology as a specialty?
So this is not very inspiring to listeners, but I kind of fell into it. I distinctly remember looking at all the medical specialties available to one, and I sort of started crossing them all off because I thought they were all too hard, and it just seemed that stroke was the term I was doing at the time. I had to make a decision, and I thought, this isn't too bad. I could do this. So I applied, and here I am.
And look, someone of your caliber, you could have spoken to us about a whole range of things around the brain today, but we've asked you to come in and speak about headache and migraine. So, Andrew, before we get into it, like, so many people seem to suffer from either headaches or migraine. What is the prevalence in Australia for how many people suffer from headaches or migraines?
Yeah, it's a very common condition. And if it feels like every second person you talk to has migraine, it's probably because a lot of people in Australia have migraine. One recent report suggests that about 4.9 million Australians have migraine. About two-thirds of those are women, and I guess the age of people who have migraine attacks sort of means that the average person with a migraine roughly meets the average demographic of the nursing workforce.
Yeah. Okay. So this is going to be a really relevant topic, not just to our workforce, but also to our patients. So your number one is not every headache is a migraine. So how do we tell the difference?
So when we're assessing a person with a headache, often the reason they come in to see us is because they don't themselves know what their headache is. Someone who gets frequent headaches for years on end is probably not going to present for care unless something changes. And one of the diagnostic traps for us is to think that because it looks like a migraine and it sounds like a migraine, it probably is a migraine. Unfortunately, we find a lot of secondary causes, sinister underlying pathologies can cause a headache that looks just like a migraine. And so it's a bit of a trap to diagnose a migraine just because the headache is severe and because it sounds like a migraine. So when we're taking a headache history, we look for a lot of red flags. And some of the obvious red flags are going to be things like a recent history of head trauma. But there are other red flags that might not be quite so obvious. Such as a first headache in an older person, say over 50, according to the way that the guidelines write these things, or a sudden severe headache that begins very quickly, what we call a thunderclap headache, rising to its maximal intensity over a matter of seconds or over a minute or so, but the kind of headache that comes on quickly like you got hit in the head with something. Those sort of red flags mean that we really shouldn't be diagnosing a migraine unless we're really taking care to rule out all the sinister causes of a headache.
So I'm still a bit confused. Is there something that differentiates a headache from a migraine? Like, are there features that you say this is a headache and features that you say this is a migraine?
Yeah, so one of the biggest problems with diagnosing migraine is that there is no diagnostic test. So we'd love to be able to do a blood test or a scan which proves that the headache is a migraine. And we can do tests in people with headache to rule out other causes of headache, but the diagnosis of migraine itself is a clinical diagnosis. This being the case, we've got these international definitions for what counts as a migraine, and you have to have several attacks and they have to last a certain amount of time and have certain clinical features, and they're online and published. What we're looking for a classic history of migraine is to find a history which neatly meets that description. Typically a severe throbbing headache lasting many hours associated with sensitivity to bright light or loud noises, often with some nausea and vomiting along with it. If someone has a headache like that, that would fit with migraine, but as I said earlier, you wouldn't diagnose someone with migraine if that's the first time that they've ever had it. And within the diagnostic criteria is the requirement to have several attacks of that nature before making that diagnosis. So a migraine is a very specific kind of headache. Plenty of other kinds of headaches, but a very particular kind that is worth diagnosing.
It's kind of like one of those terms, a bit like flu, that anyone that has symptoms will self-diagnose themselves with having, oh, I've had a migraine today. And it's like, did you though, or did you have a headache?
Well, this is exactly right. Clinically at the bedside, it's one of those words that patients don't always mean the same thing we mean when they use that word, and it's important for us as clinicians not just to borrow the terminology the patients used, but also to, you know, critically appraise the history and the data that the patient has presented and form our own conclusion about whether they are actually describing a migraine or are they in fact describing some other kind of headache that we need to do something different about.
So essentially you can have a severe headache and you can have severe headaches kind of on a regular basis and not be a migraine sufferer.
Indeed.
Yeah. Yeah. So your number two is that migraines need diagnosing so that you can give specific treatments.
Well, one of the reasons why we want to make a good diagnosis of migraine is because just as there's no one diagnostic test for migraine, there's no one specific treatment either. You can reassure patients that there's a range of treatments that they can take for migraine, but that by the same token just infers or implies that none of them are fantastic. Because if there was one tablet that always treated migraine really well and didn't cause side effects, that's the only one we'd ever use. So the fact that we've got a range of it is both a cause for hope, but also, you know, a little bit disappointing. That being said, a lot of the more recent research has been specifically focusing on migraine because it is so common and because we are understanding more about what causes migraine and therefore what we can do to treat migraine. Most of the treatments that we used to use in the 1980s and 90s and the last few decades have been borrowed from other fields of medicine. And so we might use antidepressants or blood tablets that were initially marketed for other conditions like antihypertensives. In recent years, though, with a better understanding of what causes migraine, we're able to design treatments that specifically target the mechanism of the generation of a headache, for example. And so you don't want to be using those treatments for a non-migraine headache because they won't work. If you don't diagnose migraine, you're less likely to think of using them.
So can I ask, when you stated the prevalence, you were saying that, you know, 2/3 of the time the sufferers are women. What is it? Like, is it because it's tied to hormonal differences, or why is it that women suffer more from headaches and or migraines in general?
Presumably there is some genetic component, and a lot of people have a family history of migraine. It's often your mum who has the migraine as well, migraine. So there is a genetic component, but we don't know what that is in most cases. That there's a very small minority of people who have a diagnosable genetic cause for their migraine, but the average person with migraine and the average person getting migraine attacks, they may well have a family history, but we don't know what the gene is that causes it. Presumably, whatever that gene is, it leads to women having migraine more than men.
In the future, do you see that we'll get to a genetic kind of diagnostic tool for migraine? Like, is that what you see happening in the future?
I would love to see some personalized diagnostics in my lifetime or in my career even. I don't think we'll see it. I think it's quite complicated. One can always point the finger at artificial intelligence and hope that something will come along that will crack that code for us. But it's quite a complicated issue because of the lack of a diagnostic test, you really only know someone has migraine when they start getting the migraine attacks, for a start. And also because there are so many people with migraine, it's pretty hard to imagine that just one migraine gene. We're probably going to find out that it's a combination of genes combined with lifestyle and environmental factors that lead someone to both have a migraine tendency, but also to experience migraine attacks.
Hmm. So your third point is there's always new treatments for migraine sufferers. So, you know, keep trying, hang in there.
One of the more common consultations that I get and requests from GPs is to assess people for their headache. And when it's migraine, I'm often surprised by how few treatments they've tried. And often I think that's a combination of the difficulties of keeping up with the modern and newer treatments for migraine, but also the difficulties in finding the time and the energy to go and see someone about your migraine when migraine is very disruptive to your life, but it doesn't stop you often from living or living the life the way you want to live it. It just puts a lot of unnecessary boundaries around it. So thankfully, we've got newer treatments available to us, which are specifically designed for migraine. And they're not the sort of treatments that the average doctor is going to know about. And I'm describing GPs and other specialists in other fields of medicine, including physicians. It is quite hard for them to keep up with the latest treatments in migraine, not just what they are, but also their availability and also their safety in the combination with other, you know, personal factors and other medications that people use. So I think it's worth asking to see someone about headache and migraine management because these treatments really are quite effective if someone has migraine. And the only real way to find out is by having a go.
Yeah. So if you suffer regularly from chronic headaches that you don't think are migraines, but they are also, you know, debilitating and routine, is that person also, like, is it worthwhile going to see a neurologist for that as well? Or you really just focus on migraine?
I don't mind the occasional consultation with someone who's got a lot of different kinds of headache because it's quite gratifying to unpack what's going on. It's an unusual part of the body in that the head is a place where people can get more than one kind of headache. You don't tend to get two kinds of ache in your leg, you know, but people can often have more than one kind of pain in the head. One of the advantages of these newer treatments for migraine is that if we treat someone who has more than one kind of headache, and one of them happens to be migraine, we can quite effectively sometimes eliminate that kind of headache, that contributor to their overall headaches and headache burden, by treating the migraine. Not only is that good to do just from the perspective of lessening the number of headaches that people get and improving quality of life, but it also clears the air somewhat so that when we assess what's left, it's more easy to diagnose the other headaches that somebody has, and then you can really get stuck into those. Because a lot of the treatments that we give, they can be given in combination. They don't have a specific marker or lab test that we can use to tell whether they're working. So it often comes down to me prescribing something and just saying, you've got all these headaches. I think these headaches that do this, they're the ones that are probably migraine. So I'm going to give you this treatment. Can you go home and come back in 3 months, 6 months, tell me about that particular headache? Don't worry so much about the other headache. We'll get to that one because that's not going to get improved by the treatment I'm about to give you. And if you haven't unpacked which headache is which, it's very difficult for a patient to come back and perceive whether there's been any benefit, because literally the answer will be, you're giving me this new treatment and I still have headaches.
Yeah.
And my perspective is, well, if I've improved the migraine component of that, that's great. I can tick that box and move on. If I haven't had that counseling at the very beginning, they're just going to come back and say, well, I saw that guy, he gave me a treatment and I still have headaches, which is true. And unfortunately, it is a long haul, because the first treatment that I prescribe might not be the best treatment or the right treatment for their migraine. And it can take several visits and several cycles of treatments just to treat the migraine, which then allows you to tackle the next headache.
Yeah.
Which I'd imagine in isolation, trying to figure out if there's precipitance, that also gets easier as you start to limit out others. I ate this before I had a headache this time, whereas if you're getting multiple different sorts.
Yeah, education of the patient's incredibly important for that, because it is very difficult to tell whether a certain environmental factor has triggered a headache or a migraine. Sometimes the beginnings of the migraine attack cause things like changes in appetites and food cravings. So you might end up feeling like you want to have something to eat, but not necessarily realizing that you're craving chocolate per se. Then you go and have some chocolate and you get a headache, and you think, well, I guess the chocolate triggered my migraine. But it could have just been that you were always going to have that migraine attack, and it's just that you felt like having something to eat and had that chocolate as part of the migraine attack and not the other way around.
Yeah. And so when you're talking about like the variety of treatments, are they all pharmaceutical? Like what is the range of treatments?
Well, the newer treatments are pharmaceutical. There are some lifestyle changes. I mean, I'm always telling people to get more sleep and manage stress and things like that. But most people who I see have already tried those things. Like, food elimination diets can be quite difficult to do. It's quite difficult to completely eliminate certain types of food. And really, because migraine often doesn't happen every time you expose somebody to a certain food or drink, and it's not that frequent necessarily, it can be very hard, even with the professional dietitian support, to identify whether there's a non-pharmacological approach to contributor to the migraine. The newer treatments, though, there's a range of treatments, and that's also good, because people can choose something that suits them better. There's tablets, there's injections that a doctor administers, there's injections that you administer to yourself. And so we can talk about differences in people's, approach to whether they're happy to have a needle and injecting themselves, or whether they'd rather not, do that and just have tablets. And part of the role of the neurologist is to navigate all that for them.
I'm a terrible teeth grinder and a facial clencher. And during the day you can do something about that, and at night you can't. It triggers really severe headaches. I would call them headaches rather than migraines. And I have been getting Botox in my jaw and in my temple from my dentist, and it has made a massive difference. I've subsequently heard of people having Botox in their neck, etc., to help with headache and or migraines. Is that a way of the future as well? Is that part of a treatment methodology?
People who have migraine can certainly get Botox treatment for their migraine, and that's not usually given into the cheeks specifically, but a lot of people do find relief from managing triggers for their migraine, and some of the triggers can be facial pain or jaw pain from, for example, teeth grinding. And so tackling the sort of chain of events and deciding in an individual that the teeth grinding is causing pain in the masseter muscles, for example, or the temporomandibular joint, that can be an avenue, especially if that's a very potent trigger for somebody's migraine, to reducing the number of migraines overall. Because people with migraine will get attacks just out of the blue. Mm. So if you can decide, if you can identify that there is a particular trigger for that person that really brings up a large portion of their migraine attacks, then tackling that can be a very effective way to lessen the overall number of headaches.
Okay, so number four is that migraine sufferers can have more than one kind of headache. And so you'd obviously have fancy terms for that, but are you talking about that some people get a headache that's right behind their eyes and other times they get a headache that they feel at the back of their head and other times, is that what you're talking about? I mean, you'll have proper diagnostic terms. I'm just kind of describing the headache.
What I meant by that comment is not so much about the different kinds of headache you can get during a migraine attack, but also the fact that people can have more than one kind of headache. And sometimes it's best to treat those other kinds of headache at the same time, either because they're causing headaches or because they're making the migraine worse than they otherwise should be. Some of the biggest causes of headache burden, in my opinion at least, are poor sleep. So people who have insomnia and they kind of, well, I say to people, how much sleep do you get? And so I get enough. I said, how much is that? And they say, well, it's about 3 or 4 hours of sleep. And I go, well, that's probably not enough.
What?
And so, but I'm not sleepy during the day, yeah. But look, I say to people, like, do you set an alarm to get up in the morning? And they say yes. And I say, well, if you're using an alarm to wake up in the morning, you're by definition not getting as much sleep as your body wants. So it's discussions like that to just sort of reset people's understandings of what is a normal amount of XYZ, in this case, sleep. Another is sleep apnea. I mean, the number of people I meet who have uncontrolled headaches and for the purposes of this discussion, migraine, because they've got either undiagnosed sleep apnea, and you say to them, how well do you sleep? And they say, fine. You talk to the partner. And you say, how well do they sleep? And he says, well, pretty good. Do they snore? Yep, really loudly. Have you ever seen them stop breathing in the middle of the night? And said, yeah, I have to nudge him to see if he's still alive. And you go, well, maybe you should see your GP about getting your sleep apnea sorted. Mm. I think a lot of the time we bounce around seeing GPs only when we need to, because we sort of react to what's happening to us. We've got flu-like illness, so we go see the GP. But migraine and migraine attacks, they're the sort of things that you can kind of push on without ever really focusing on, and you can just sort of have them. So I think if someone's of a mind to get their migraine sorted, they might also be in the right headspace to get their sleep sorted, partly because they've obviously started thinking about what could be better with their life beyond just pushing on how they are at the moment, but also because they're obviously thinking about the long term and sorting out a few things, a bit of housekeeping for your health, which is always useful.
Yeah. Okay, I think that's really self-explanatory. So let's move on to number five, and that's sometimes the worst part of a migraine is not the headache. What does that mean? What other symptoms are you talking about?
Yeah, this is fascinating to me because when I practice general neurology, I get referrals which don't say necessarily, can you see this person who has migraine? I get referrals that say, can you see this person who has lethargy and doesn't feel right and can't concentrate and, you know, they're worried they're going to get dementia or something like that. And one of the things about migraine is that although the headache is a classic part of the attack, sometimes people don't get the headache or they get very little headache, but they get everything else. And there are phases of a migraine headache that involve a lot of really subtle changes which can add up to make life quite difficult. The prodrome, which is the first few hours, even day or so before the headache sets in.
What does that mean?
So that's just means the first few hours or so before the headache. You can call that a prodrome, but it's really just the lead-in part of the attack. Then there's a really bad headache.
Yep, okay.
And then there's what people call the post-drome, which is just several hours afterwards where people just feel rubbish, washed out, tired, whatever. And so one of the things about migraine is that certainly in the older population, but sometimes in the not-so-old population, people don't get much of a headache, but they get everything else. So they'll have hours and hours where they just don't feel right. They're irritable or their appetite changes and then they may even get some of the other features of a migraine besides headache, which include nausea or light sensitivity. And then they'll get all of the washed out feeling that people get after a migraine but without the headache. So then they're spending hours and hours, even a day or so, feeling tired, washed out, no energy, just want to lie around and can't do anything. And if that all lasts 2 days or so, maybe 3 days altogether, if someone's getting 2 or 3 attacks a week, they're probably never feeling well.
Yeah.
You know, and I just say to them, do you ever feel normal? And say, oh, rarely, because like maybe they take a holiday and everything comes good and everything lines up for them. And then they just get 1 or 2 days when everything's perfect and you think, well, number one, that just proves your brain's healthy because otherwise you wouldn't have a day like that. But on the other hand, it also tells me that maybe the other 363 days of the year were the bad ones, and those 2 days tell me what life could be like if I could help this person get their migraine under control. So I often find myself turning around a clinical consultation from I'm worried I'm getting Alzheimer's into I think you can treat this. Now, that's not to say everyone with memory troubles has migraine, because there's a lot of other clinical features that go along with that to make you think that's what's actually happening. And I've got to say, more common than migraine is poor sleep when it comes to my brain isn't working, what's wrong with it. But it's quite satisfying because of the existence of these migraine-specific treatments. Quite satisfying to treat someone who is basically losing their job or not able to fulfill all of the social functions they want to fulfill and live the life they want to live, just by treating them with migraine treatments, even though they don't have a lot of headache, you can turn that around.
Yeah.
And I've had some really big successes clinically by treating migraine, even though the person didn't have a lot of headache.
So you've told us, you know, 4.9 million people in Australia have got, you know, migraine and or headaches on top of that. At what point does someone say, I've had enough of this, to the GP, I need to see a neurologist? Or at what point should someone go and have a further investigation or, you know, a CT scan or an MRI? Like what's the threshold for further investigation?
So there's two reasons to want to be referred somewhere. I mean, one is to make sure there's nothing sinister going on. And there's all those red flags I talked about before. And often it just comes down to just use your common sense and don't ignore things. Like, for example, if you've got a headache and you can't wake someone up, well, that's probably not just a headache. And that's a red flag that something more needs to be done. So there's a pathway for investigating that. And that might involve seeing a GP. And if it's very acute and severe, that might include calling the paramedics and calling QAS, or it might involve calling a health line like 13 Health. Around here, we would recommend getting some advice on what to do and whether escalation beyond just home remedies is appropriate. Because I don't expect people are going to who don't practice in the field of either first response or neurology are necessarily going to remember all the potential red flags and assess whether someone has them or not. So we've got this pathway and this system that helps us make sure that the people who need to go to hospital and have an urgent scan get one. People who have less acute severe headaches, which don't feel like the sort of headaches they need to call an ambulance for, there are guidelines that primary care use, general practitioners can refer to and use to decide which people should have imaging and which people don't need imaging. They're similar to the ones that would recommend going to a hospital. For example, if you never get headaches and you suddenly start getting headaches, even if they're not severe headaches, if they're sort of getting worse and worse and worse, or they're just not getting better, that's probably worth talking to your doctor about, even if it isn't dangerous, because why live with those? Because that's the first group of people who would go and see the doctor or seek medical advice. And what should I be investigated because there's some sinister cause for my headache? But the other would be, maybe I don't have a sinister cause for my headache, but maybe I don't have to live with these headaches anymore. Yeah. Maybe I should go and get someone to sort out my headaches for me. I mean, if you've been reassured by a clinician that you don't have a sinister kind of headache, by all means, Google it. You know, you may well find a reputable website that helps you get more sleep or helps you work out a few other things in your life that need to be ironed out. And if that sorts your headache out, you everything's great. But there is a medical system that allows for people to get referred into a specialist to sort out those tricky headaches that just won't go away. And I think that's worth doing, even if you aren't someone who wants to have more recently available pharmaceutical treatments. There are other ways of managing headache that don't require that, and you may not ever come across those with your Googling.
So I think it's important to note that, you know, out of the 4.9 million people who currently suffer from migraines, most of those are not going to be a sinister, a tumour, or something that's a red flag. But essentially what I've heard you say is that if you are suffering regularly from either headaches, migraines, and or both, and it's impacting your quality of life, then you really should go and have a conversation with your general practitioner.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I mean, I just think that if you have a condition that is limiting your quality of life, even if it doesn't kill you, why do we spend so much time looking up how to lose weight and how to improve other aspects of our life while still putting up with severe, frequent headaches? I think that that's the sort of thing that won't kill you, but why have a discounted quality of life for the rest of your life because you haven't taken the opportunity to address that now? Because let's say you want to live another 50 years. Are you going to go and see someone about that in 30 years' time and then look back and think, well, I could have had no headache for 30 years. Why didn't I do it then?
Yeah.
I'd just recommend getting on and getting it done.
How often in your working day do you say, it's not a tumour?
Not as often as I should. That's a great, great movie.
It is a great movie. Okay, such an important conversation that we've had with you today, Andrew, and I'm just going to try and summarise that very succinctly. Please correct me if I'm, say something wrong. So your number one is not every headache is a migraine. And I guess what I heard you say is that there's no specific diagnostic test to prove whether something is a headache or migraine. It's quite a tricky way to determine. But essentially, if you've had several attacks, if your history is of a severe throbbing headache with sensitivity to noise or light, and or nausea, then it's really worth getting an investigation about it. Your number two is migraines need diagnosing for specific treatments. And again, you said there's no one quick fix for this. So what you want to do is absolutely find out what it is and then trial that. And if it doesn't work, go back, which leads us beautifully to number three, which is there's always new treatments coming up for migraines. And you spoke about that a lot of those new treatments are pharmaceutical, but they could also very much be lifestyle. So look at things like how much stress, how much sleep you're getting, doing food elimination is quite tricky because certain migraines can almost trigger a craving and then you have it that's what you depended on. But we also spoke about Botox and a few things like that as well. Number four is that migraine sufferers can have more than one kind of headache. And again, you were saying that people often come to you and when you investigate something like their quality of sleep or sleep apnea, that you can discover that there's a collection of things causing a collection of problems, and sometimes those problems lead to migraines. So go back and have a conversation first and foremost with your general practitioner. And number five is sometimes the worst part of a migraine is not the headache. And so that some people are potentially suffering from migraines, but because the headache is not the predominant feature, that it's something more subtle, but it's actually, hours to days where you're being impacted by mood, energy, appetite changes, nausea, exhaustion, feeling wiped out, then it possibly is a migraine, that the cluster of symptoms is just confusing people because the headache's not the worst component. But overall, the overarching message I have heard today is that if there is something going on with your head, either acutely or chronically, that is impacting your quality of life, that could be caused by a range of problems, and it's really worthwhile going and having a conversation with your general practitioner, having a look what could be the cause of that. And if it's ongoing, then potentially going to see a neurologist and having that further explored is definitely worthwhile. How'd I go?
Absolutely fantastic.
Yay! Thank you very much for joining us today on Five Things.
Thanks for having me.
Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital Five Things Nursing podcast acknowledges the Turrbal and Yuggera as the First Nations owners of the lands we now tread. We pay respect to their elders, laws, customs and creation spirits. We recognise that these lands have always been places of healing, teaching and learning. We also wish to acknowledge the First Nations people of the lands of our global community and encourage our listeners to seek out, listen and learn from the knowledge held in your shared space. As well as all major podcast outlets, you can find us at fivethingsnursing.podbean.com. Please also subscribe and give us a rating on your listening platform of choice. This helps others find the podcast. And finally, if you'd like to connect with Liz or myself on Twitter, we can be found at LizCrow2. And for me, it's inject_orange. We would absolutely love to hear your thoughts, ideas, or feedback. Thanks for listening to Five Things,